Chapter 6
Nature's little danger signals, Senator Rosewater said to Sylvia and McAllister and Mushari darkly. How many did I miss? All of them, I guess.
Don't blame yourself, said McAllister.
If a man has but one child, said the senator, and the family is famous for producing unusual, strong-willed individuals, what standards can the man have for deciding whether or not his child is a nut?
Don't blame yourself.
I have spent my life demanding that people blame themselves for their misfortunes.
You've made exceptions.
Damn few.
Include yourself among the damn few. That's where you belong.
I often think that Elliot would not have turned out as he has if there hadn't been all that whoop-de-doo about his being mascot of the fire department when he was a child. God, how they spoiled him. Let him ride on the seat of the number one pumper, let him ring the bell, taught him how to make the truck backfire by turning the ignition off and on, laughed like crazy when he blew the muffler off. They all smelled like booze, of course, too.
He nodded and blinked.
Booze and fire engines. A happy childhood regained. I don't know. I just don't know. Whenever we went out there, I told him it was home, but I never thought he would be dumb enough to believe it.
I blame myself, said the senator.
Good for you, said McAllister. And while you're at it, be sure to hold yourself responsible for everything that happened to Elliot during World War II. It's your fault, without a doubt, that all those firemen were in that smoke-filled building.
McAllister was speaking of the proximate cause of Elliot's nervous breakdown near the end of the war. The smoke-filled building was a clarinet factory in Bavaria. It was supposedly infested by a hedgehog of SS troops. Elliot led a platoon from his company in an assault on the building. His customary weapon was a Thompson submachine gun, but he went in with a rifle and fixed bayonet this time, because of the danger of shooting one of his own men in the smoke. He had never stuck a bayonet into anybody before, not in years of carnage. He pitched a grenade into a window. When it went off, Captain Rosewater went through the window himself, found himself standing in a sea of very still smoke, whose undulating surface was level with his eyes. He tilted his head back to keep his nose in air. He could hear Germans, but he couldn't see them. He took a step forward, stumbled over one body, fell on another. They were Germans who had been killed by his grenade. He stood up, found himself face to face with a helmeted German in a gas mask. Elliot, like the good soldier he was, jammed his knee into the man's groin, drove his bayonet into his throat, withdrew the bayonet, smashed the man's jaw with his rifle butt. And then Elliot heard an American sergeant yelling somewhere off to his left. The visibility was apparently a lot better over there, for the sergeant was yelling,
"Cease fire! Hold your fire, you guys! Jesus Christ, these aren't soldiers! They're firemen!"
It was true. Elliot had killed three unarmed firemen. They were ordinary villagers, engaged in the brave and uncontroversial business of trying to keep a building from combining with oxygen. When the medics got the masks off the three Elliot had killed, they proved to be two old men and a boy. The boy was the one Elliot had bayoneted. He didn't look more than 14. Elliot seemed reasonably well for about 10 minutes after that, and then he calmly lay down in front of a moving truck. The truck stopped in time, but the wheels were touching Captain Rosewater. When some of his horrified men picked him up, they found out Elliot was stiff, so rigid that they might have carried him by his hair and his heels. He stayed like that for 12 hours, and would not speak or eat, so they shipped him back to Gay Paris.
What did he seem like there in Paris? The senator wanted to know. Did he seem sane enough to you then?
That's how I happened to meet him.
I don't understand.
Father's string quartet played for some of the mental patients in one of the American hospitals. And Father got talking to Elliot, and Father thought Elliot was the sanest American he had ever met. When Elliot was well enough to leave, Father had him to dinner. I remember Father's introduction. I want you all to meet the only American who has so far noticed the Second World War.
What did he say that was so sane?
It was the impression he made, really, more than the particular things he said. I remember how my father described him. He said, "This young captain I'm bringing home, he despises art. Can you imagine? Despises it, and yet he does it in such a way that I can't help loving him for it." What he's saying, I think, is that art has failed him, which, I must admit, is a very fair thing for a man who has bayoneted a 14-year-old boy in the line of duty to say. I loved Elliot on sight.
Isn't there some other word you could use?
Then what?
Then love.
What better word is there?
It was a perfectly good word until Elliot got hold of it. It's spoiled for me now. Elliot did to the word love what the Russians did to the word democracy. If Elliot is going to love everybody, no matter what they are, no matter what they do, then those of us who love particular people for particular reasons had better find ourselves a new word. He looked up at an oil painting of his deceased wife. For instance, I loved her more than I loved our garbage collector, which makes me guilty of the most unspeakable of modern crimes. Discrimination. Sylvia smiled wanly.
For want of a better word, could I go on using the old one? Just for tonight?
On your lips, it still has meaning.
I loved him on sight in Paris, and I love him when I think of him now.
You must have realized pretty early in the game that you had a nut on your hands.
There was the drinking.
There's the heart of the problem right there.
And there was that awful business with Arthur Garvey Ulm.
Ulm was a poet Elliot had given $10,000 to when the foundation was still in New York.
That poor Arthur told Elliot he wanted to be free to tell the truth, regardless of the economic consequences, and Elliot wrote him a tremendous check right then and there. It was at a cocktail party,
said Sylvia.
I remember Arthur Godfrey was there, and Robert Frost and Salvador Dali, and a lot of others, too. You go tell the truth, by God. It's about time somebody did, Elliot said to him. And if you need any more money to tell the truth, you just come back to me. Poor Arthur wandered around the party in a daze, showing people the check, asking them if it could possibly be real. They all told him it was a perfectly wonderful check, and he came back to Elliot, made sure again that the check was not a joke, and then, almost hysterically, he begged Elliot to tell him what he should write about. The truth, said Elliot. You're my patron, and I thought that as my patron, you might... I'm not your patron. I'm a fellow American who is paying your money to find out what the truth is. That's a very different sort of thing. Right, right, said Arthur. That's the way it should be. That's the way I want it. I just thought there was maybe some special subject you pick the subject and be good and fearless about it. Right. And before he knew what he was doing, poor Arthur saluted. And I don't think he'd even been in the army or navy or anything. And he left Elliot. But he went around the party again, asking everybody what sorts of things Elliot was interested in. He finally came back to tell Elliot that he had once been a migratory fruit picker, and that he wanted to write a cycle of poems about how miserable the fruit pickers were. Elliot drew himself up to his full height, looked down on Arthur, his eyes blazing, and he said, so that everybody could hear, "Sir? Do you realize that the Rosewaters are the founders and the majority stockholders in the United Fruit Company?"
"That wasn't true," said the senator.
"Of course it wasn't," said Sylvia.
"Did the foundation have any United Fruit stock at all at that time?" the senator asked McAllister.
"Oh, 5,000 shares, maybe?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing,"
McAllister agreed.
Poor Arthur turned crimson, slunk away, came back again, asked Elliot very humbly who his favorite poet was. "I don't know his name," said Elliot, "and I wish I did, because it's the only poem I ever thought enough of to commit to heart." Where did you see it?
It was written on a wall, Mr. Of the men's room of a beer joint on the border between Rosewater and Brown counties in Indiana. The Log Cabin Inn.
Oh, this is weird. This is weird, said the senator. The Log Cabin Inn must have burned down, oh God, in 1934 or so. How weird that Elliot should remember it.
Was he ever in it?
McAllister asked.
Once. Just once, now that I think back, said the senator. It was a dreadful robber's roost, and we would never have stopped there if the car hadn't boiled over. Elliot must have been 10, 12, and he probably did use the men's room, and he probably did see something written on the wall. Something he never forgot.
He nodded.
How weird. How weird.
What was the poem?
Said McAllister. Sylvia apologized to the two old men for having to be coarse, and then she recited the two lines Elliot had recited loudly for Ulm.
We don't piss in your ashtrays, so please don't throw cigarettes in our urinals. The poor poet fled in tears,
said Sylvia.
For months after that, I was in terror of opening small packages, lest one of them contain the ear of Arthur Garvey Ulm.
Hates the arts, said McAllister.
He clucked.
He's a poet himself,
said Sylvia.
That's news to me, said the senator. I never saw any of it.
He used to write me poems sometimes.
He's probably happiest when writing on the walls of public lavatories. I often wondered who did it. Now I know. It's my poetic son.
Does he write on lavatory walls?
McAllister asked.
I heard that he did, said Sylvia. It was innocent. It wasn't obscene. During the New York days, people told me Elliot was writing the same message in men's rooms all over town.
Do you remember what it was?
Yes. If you would be unloved and forgotten, be reasonable. As far as I know, that was original with him.
At that moment, Elliot was trying to read himself back to sleep with the manuscript of a novel by none other than Arthur Garvey Ulm. The name of the book was Get With Child a Mandrake Root, a line from a poem by John Donne. The dedication read, For Elliot Rosewater, My Compassionate Turquoise. And under that was another quotation from Donne. A compassionate turquoise which doth tell, by looking pale, the wearer is not well. A covering letter from Ulm explained that the book was going to be published by Palindrome Press in time for Christmas, and was going to be a joint selection, along with The Cradle of Erotica, of a major book club.
You have no doubt forgotten me, compassionate turquoise,
the letter said in part.
The Arthur Garvey Ulm you knew was a man well worth forgetting. What a coward he was, and what a fool he was to think he was a poet. And what a long, long time it took him to understand exactly how generous and kind your cruelty was. How much you managed to tell me about what was wrong with me, and what I should do about it, and how few words you used. Here, then, 14 years later, are 800 pages of prose by me. They could not have been created by me without you, and I do not mean your money. Money is shit. Which is one of the things I have tried to say in the book. I mean your insistence that the truth be told about this sick, sick society of ours, and that the words for the telling could be found on the walls of restrooms.
Elliot couldn't remember who Arthur Garvey Ulm was, and so was even further from knowing what advice he might have given the man. The clues Ulm offered were so nebulous, Elliot was pleased that he had given someone useful advice. Was thrilled even when Ulm declared,
Let them shoot me, let them hang me, but I have told the truth. The gnashing of the teeth of the Pharisees, Madison Avenue phonies, and Philistines will be music to my ears. With your divine assistance, I have let the gin of truth about them out of the bottle, and they will never, 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 ever get it back in.
Elliot began to read avidly the truths Ulm expected to get killed for telling.
Chapter 1. I twisted her arm until she opened her legs, and she gave a little scream, half joy, half pain. How do you figure a woman, as I rammed the old Avenger home?
Elliot found himself possessed of an erection.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, he said to his procreative organ. How irrelevant can you be?
If only there had been a child, said the senator again, and then the density of his regret was penetrated by this thought, that it was cruel of him to speak so to the woman who had failed to bear the magic child. Excuse an old fool, Sylvia. I can understand why you might thank God there is no child.
Sylvia, returning from her cry in the bathroom, experimented with small gestures, all indicating that she would have loved such a baby, but that she might have pitied it too.
I would never thank God for a thing like that.
May I ask you a highly personal question?
It's what life does all the time.
Do you think it is remotely possible that he will ever reproduce?
I haven't seen him for 3 years.
I'm asking you to make an extrapolation.
I can only tell you, she said, that towards the end of our marriage, lovemaking was something less than a mania with us both. He was once a sweet fanatic for lovemaking, but not for making children of his own.
The senator clucked ruefully.
If only I had taken proper care of my child, he winced. I paid a call to the psychoanalyst Elliot used to go to in New York. Finally got around to it last year. I seem to get around to everything about Elliot 20 years too late. I've never been able to get it through my head that such a splendid animal could ever go so much to hell.
Mushari concealed his hunger for clinical details of Elliot's ailment, waited tensely for someone to urge the senator to continue. No one did, so Mushari exposed himself.
And, what did the doctor say?
The senator, suspecting nothing, resumed his tale.
These people never want to talk about what you want to talk about. It's always something else. When he found out who I was, he didn't want to talk about Elliot. He wanted to talk about the Rosewater Law.
The Rosewater Law was what the senator thought of as his legislative masterpiece. It made the publication or possession of obscene materials a federal offense, carrying penalties up to $50,000 and 10 years in prison, without hope of parole. It was a masterpiece because it actually defined obscenity. Obscenity, it said, is any picture or phonograph record or any written matter calling attention to reproductive organs, bodily discharges, or bodily hair.
This psychoanalyst, the senator complained, wanted to know about my childhood. He wanted to go into my feelings about bodily hair.
The senator shuddered.
I asked him to kindly get off the subject, that my revulsions were shared, so far as I knew, by all decent men.
He pointed to McAllister, simply wanting to point at someone, anyone.
There's your key to pornography. Other people say, oh, how can you recognize it? How can you tell it from art and all that? I've written the key into law. The difference between pornography and art is bodily hair.
He flushed, apologized abjectly to Sylvia.
I beg your pardon, my dear.
Mushari had to prod him again.
And the doctor didn't say anything about Elliot?
The damn doctor said Elliot never told him a damn thing, but well-known facts from history. Almost all of them related to the oppression of oddballs or the poor. He said any diagnosis he made of Elliot's disease would have to be irresponsible speculation. As a deeply worried father, I told the doctor, go ahead and guess as much as you want to about my son. I won't hold you responsible. I'd be most grateful if you'd say anything, true or not, because I ran out of ideas about my boy, responsible or irresponsible, true or not, years ago. Stick your stainless steel spoon in this unhappy old man's brains, doctor, I told him, and stir. He said to me, before I tell you what my irresponsible thoughts are, I'll have to discuss sexual perversion some. I intend to involve Elliot in the discussion, so if an involvement of that sort would affect you violently, let's have our talk come to an end right here.
"Carry on," I said. "I'm an old futz, and the theory is that an old futz can't be hurt very much by anything anybody says. I've never believed it before, but I'll try to believe it now." "Very well," he said. "Let's assume that a healthy young man is supposed to be sexually aroused by an attractive woman, not his mother or sister. If he's aroused by other things, another man, say, or an umbrella, or the ostrich boa of the Empress Josephine, or a sheep, or a corpse, or his mother, or a stolen garter belt, he is what we call a pervert." I replied that I had always known such people were about, but that I'd never thought much about them because there didn't seem to be much to think about them. "Good," he said. "That's a calm, reasonable reaction, Senator Rosewater, that I'm frank to say surprises me. Let us hasten on to the admission that every case of perversion is essentially a case of crossed wires. Mother Nature and society order a man to take his sex to such and such a place and do thus and so with it. Because of the crossed wires, the unhappy man enthusiastically goes straight to the wrong place. Proudly, vigorously does some hideously inappropriate thing, and he can count himself lucky if he is simply crippled for life by a police force rather than killed by a mob." "I began to feel terror for the first time in many years," said the senator, "and I told the doctor so." "Good," he said again. "The most exquisite pleasure in the practice of medicine comes from nudging a layman in the direction of terror, then bringing him back to safety again. Elliot certainly has his wires crossed, but the inappropriate thing to which the short circuit has caused him to bring his sexual energies isn't necessarily such a very bad thing." "What is it?" I cried, thinking, in spite of myself, of Elliot stealing women's underwear, of Elliot snipping off locks of hair on subways, of Elliot as a peeping Tom. The senator from Indiana shuddered. "Tell me, doctor, tell me the worst. Elliot is bringing his sexual energies to what?" "To Utopia," he said. Frustration made Norman Mushari sneeze.